This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge the traditional owners of this country and pay our respects to elders past and present. Welcome to Under One Blue Roof, your podcast exploring the problem of climate-driven homelessness. Here, we ponder some of the big questions about housing, social justice, planetary boundaries, and more, and listen to stories from experts in the field who explain just how it's all related. Let's get to know the human face of climate change.
Hi, and thanks for joining us Under One Blue Roof. I'm your host, Marushka Saldana, a Master of Environment student and social enterprise practitioner. We're going to be talking about community mobilization and action-based change. I'm delighted to be joined on the show by Ben Walter. Ben has over 10 years of local and international experience, from grassroots through to cutting-edge social enterprise, community development, disaster recovery and resilience, and project management. Ben has worked with Keep Australia Beautiful, Ceres Environmental Park, Tongarong Land and Waters, and Australian Business Volunteers, plus many more. Ben has a breadth of knowledge, experience, and passion for engagement, as well as environmental sustainability and sharing our collective human global experience. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Marushka.
It's so nice to see you without being covered in mud and hauling sandbags off the banks of the Murray River, I have to say.
Yeah, that was quite a day, wasn't it? It was fun.
It was. It was a hot day, and there were about, I think, 10 volunteers plus yourself supervising us as part of that disaster relief program in Echuca. And it's safe to say we're both looking a little more put together and less disheveled.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was a great day though. That was it was just a pilot project, just to cast the net out and see who's interested in catching the train up and spending the day in Echuca doing some disaster recovery with the locals there. And it went really well.
Yeah, it was a great day, organised by Keep Australia Beautiful and Disaster Relief Australia, as it was a pilot program and something that was really needed at that point, because there had just been such bad floods in Echuca and all along that part of Victoria where those rivers intersect. There are three of them. It caused such destruction going up and down the roads in Echuca. I've spent a bit of time there. I went on my grade six camp there, and, you know, to see it looking the way it was, you know, was tough. And it's really tough to see the impact it has on the community and the locals, people being pushed out of homes and homes being destroyed or, you know, left in no state to live in. And yeah, we were spending some time lifting sandbags, which was a very small part that, you know, you play as a volunteer, but hopefully something that made a little bit of difference. So it was a great day that you organised.
Unfortunately, I think it's the new normal for Australia and probably the world, but we're experiencing compounding disasters with the looming climate change challenges, and it's just back-to-back floods, fires, droughts and storms, and the communities go through a bit of a cycle of disaster response, disaster recovery, building their resilience and then stepping towards preparedness. And they're basically all communities are somewhere on that wheel. And they're just the more frequent that these disasters keep happening, the harder the communities are being hit. There's still lots of challenges ahead, but there's also some great things that are coming from it. Lots of really great community spirit, people like us jumping on the train for the day and going to help out. But there's a really good ABC podcast called After the Disaster, and one of the chapters they talk about post-traumatic growth, this idea that people didn't ask for this disaster to hit. They weren't necessarily ready. Oftentimes people in remote Victoria have gone out there so that they're not having to deal with cities and large groups of people, and then suddenly after a disaster, they're forced to come together, to plan together, to recover together. And it's challenging, but pushing us out of our comfort zones and forcing communities to step up to the challenge can achieve some really amazing growth. There is a positive lining to it if you look closely.
Positive flow-on effect from crisis and the pulling together of communities that happens in times of disaster is really incredible. You know, the human spirit is very difficult to break, and in fact, sometimes comes out stronger when it's exposed to that level of stress, and you really see how resilient people can be, and we are stronger together. I want to talk a little bit about home and this idea of home. It's depending on who you are and where you come from, either this constant that you know you've got somewhere to go, to come back to, somewhere that's your center in life. And for others, it can be a really destabilizing thing, or it may not exist at all. So there are a lot of different ways that that might look. It also determines the types of opportunities and experiences that we have. I know that you're moving to New Zealand, so your home is changing quite radically, which is exciting and maybe a little scary. Can you tell us about how your understanding of home has informed your own identity and what you think about when you think of home?
Sure. So I'm a middle-class, middle-aged white guy in Australia. So I've possibly, in my sort of last 20 years, haven't really necessarily felt like I'm deeply connected to Australia for, you know, generations. I'm not Indigenous and don't have a long lineage of, you know, many, many generations and history here. So I feel like I'm a custodian and a temporary dweller on this particular corner of the earth. I've been really fortunate to have travelled a lot in the last 20 years. I've been to India over 20 times, spent a lot of time in China and travelled any chance I got. With a series for 10 years, I ran Series Global, which is an amazing international friendship building experience, fostering relationships between our local East Brunswick Series community and communities overseas. So that's been really great for me to be able to get my wings out and lift my spirit and travel and have those amazing experiences. But I've grown up in Melbourne. My family lived early days in Coburg in a big old castle on the Grove, which was derelict and I think it was condemned by the Department of Housing, and my parents, uncles, aunts and cousins all got together and bought it and did it up. So we had a upstairs, downstairs, had a turret that you could climb up. It was cute. That was a five-year project, so that was a great early primary school age thing to do. I was just thinking the other day, I went to Coburg Pool day before yesterday with little 10-month-old baby Rumi, who's the star of the show, the light of my life at the moment. He's a complete dag. But we went to the pool. We were the first ones at the pool, and it was super exciting. And we got in the water, and then he was paddling around, and I was holding him on his back, and he was having a great time. And I remembered the 1983 dust storm that came, and I was older than him, but I remember being at the pool, at Coburg Pool, and it was packed on a hot day, and then this dust storm came and there was chaos and panic and everyone had to run and get out of there, and I left my kickboard there. So disappointed. Had a little yellow kickboard. I was thinking of that the other day and I was remembering that was 40 years ago, and I'm like, whoa, I'm in the same patch. I'm in the same neighbourhood 40 years later with my little baby boy, and it was cute. It was like, oh yeah, I am connected to this space. So you spend enough time somewhere and that's where you're from.
Yeah, generations of Walters have been in and around Coburg at the swimming pool.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool when you think about it, for a family to stay in one place. Like, that may be common, I don't know, but it's something that I think you can look at and feel a sense of community and belonging and nostalgia as well, you know, of this is where I grew up and this is where my son is growing up, and there's something really nice about that. So that's so great. You'll have a whole new set of adventures to pursue when you're in New Zealand on your next great chapter.
That's right. That's right. So my partner Josephine's a Kiwi and she's been in Australia for 11 or 12 years now. So I'm to head home and reconnect with her family and her community over there. We're doing a one-year plan and then we'll see how we go. But nice to be able to extend our networks and and connect with other communities and reconnect with old ones. So, yeah, we're looking forward to that.
That sounds great. I was thinking back to my time in school when I knew that I was going to be talking to you today. And the reason being is that we, as a school community, would do a lot of really fun environmental initiatives that would be completely student run and volunteer based. And there would be things like rubbish free lunches that would be encouraged. I went to a pretty artsy school in the Northwest. And I had moved from New South Wales, where I went to a very strict private school. So moving from the private to the public school education system was quite different. And suddenly there were these like hippies that were telling me, you know, you can't bring plastic to school. That's not okay. And I was shocked. I was, you know, really in my bubble, I think. And that was the first time I really understood what it meant to change your behavior or change what you're doing in order to benefit the environment and the place that we live, places that we live in. And I was just wondering about some of the programs and the campaigns that you've worked on and how you've found them to be effective in influencing change in our communities.
Oh, I think I remember years ago when I just finished high school and I think I'd done a year of tertiary study, and then I was like, hang on, I'm not ready for this. I want a year out. I'm going to go do something else. And I went up to Jabiluka Mine in Northern Territory, and that was a Rio Tinto uranium mine attached to the Ranger mine on Aboriginal land, the Mirarr people's land, on an amazing rock escarpment. So it was significant for me to travel from Melbourne all the way up because it was environmental, it was indigenous, it had a global issue of uranium, and being young, fresh out of school, self-righteous little fella, I was like, I'm going to go and protest. So we went up there, we were there for a couple of months. It was a long time, and it was there was a lot of media. Peter Garrett was there and James Morrison playing his trumpet and a whole lot of international media attention. There's about 600 people there at the camp, at the blockade over the couple of months. And then in the end, the wet season was coming and we were like, right, what are we going to do? Are we going to, we haven't stopped the mine. The world's watching. There's protests in all the capital cities. How are we going to make some change? And we thought, we're going to get arrested. So we decided everybody had the choice whether they're going to get arrested or not, and got a bit of time to think about it. And I rang up my dad and I said, mind if I get arrested?
Naturally.
Like, well, I suppose I can't really do much. I was like, yep, great answer. Okay. That was on a public phone box back in the day. Anyway, we all stormed the mine and we totally trashed it and had a great time and then got arrested. It was an overnight. We were covered in charcoal from as camouflage. We had to be below ground level under infrared UV detectors and stuff like that. It was quite exciting. And then we got to the compound, bolt cutted the fence open. We all came from four different directions and the plan was to arrive right at sunrise. We'd been walking all night under the moonlight, so we were kind of delirious. And then we're at the corner like, Is it all happening? What's going on? Are we in? And then someone had run inside, climbed up the cherry picker that was holding a light and unraveled an Aboriginal flag and waved it over the one giant spotlight. So the whole mine had a really nice sort of shadow cast over it, and everyone knew that someone was in there, so we all went for it. 120 people got arrested, I think, that night, that morning, and then spent all day holding up the tractors and the trucks and causing a ruckus, and then getting ferried off to the police station in the Dibby vans. We were all in jail for between, or somewhere up for quite a while, but I was there for about 5 days, and we were all packed in there, and so we had to take it in turns to lie down and rest, and others standing up or playing games and stuff. We took the charcoal off each other's face and painted a big mural on the walls of the prison cell, and it was a rock escarpment and the site, and then beautiful forest and a huge nuclear mushroom cloud. It was, I remember that. That was 1997, I think, 98. But anyway, that sort of activism and that activity was huge for us at the time, and we were watching to see whether it made a difference. You know, are these rat bags who are going and breaking down fences and messing up tractors going to make a difference? And in the end, it did. That was the end of a long-running campaign of protests. And it was the shareholders of Rio Tinto who came together and held an extraordinary general meeting where the shareholders addressed the organisation and said, we don't want you to do this. You know, and these are mining company shareholders. They're pretty, you know, they're not activists, but they saw the damage to the brand and the reputation of the corporate mining company, enough so that they came and called a meeting and said, we don't want you to expand through Jabiluka. And they haven't. Rio Tinto have still held the license for the last 20 years, 24 years, I think, haven't acted on it. So whether they're waiting for an entire generation to forget or not, I'm not sure. But that particular protest and group of activists getting together to create trouble was a success. So it can work.
That is so cool. I feel like you and your friends are my new heroes. That sounds like one of the most disruptive scallywag type things that you can do as someone who cares about your environment. And there are no boundaries really when you think about the lengths you might go to see something you love protected. And it's not just our families, it's not just people, it's places and environments and ecosystems that hold so much value. And obviously, at some level, corporations see that, and that's reflected in their stakeholders' interests, and reputational risk is such a huge factor. So sounds like getting arrested did the job.
Yeah, absolutely. that was one success story. There have been plenty of other unsuccessful stories. That was late 90s, so there was lots happening in the world. There was protests in Davos, in Switzerland, Geneva and Seattle, and the World Economic Forum in Melbourne around the Crown Casino. There was a wave of civil society standing up and really protesting really hard, and they were quite scared. It was pretty much about WTO rules and the controlling international globalization bodies, and nowadays they are not so much the issues. The, you know, the free trade agreements have all gone in. China's boomed from supplying, you know, all sorts of stuff to the West, the insatiable appetites of the West, and so on. So 20 years later, a new frontline has real challenges to the world. It's got to be climate change. The disasters and the world that our kids are going to grow up into is pretty scary. So, yeah, I reckon that's going to be the new wave of protests, as long as it's not a slow boil and we all just they hit us too quickly.
Yeah, and you look back at, you know, the years of protest and how it's evolved over time from, you know, with the women's rights movement and Black Lives Matter and the environmental school strikes for climate, they all carry this important message, but they come up against such opposition in a lot of ways. And there's this tension between you know, policymakers and the law and protesters and community, there's this really interesting dynamic that seems to play out in a similar way, regardless of what it is you're protesting. And I think that's an interesting thread that comes through when you're talking about mobilizing communities. And you did mention action, taking action and activism. Do you think that there's a difference, and do we need more of one versus the other in the fight against climate change?
I don't know if my understanding of those two things is accurate, but how I'd sort of explain it, action, I imagine anyone can take action. You can all do the things within your power that you feel like you need to do for a particular cause. So if that's being more sustainable or being polite or, you know, doing the things that you're capable of. And then I imagine activism's about influencing others and about rallying up a community to get behind your wild ideas. Or, you know, activism sort of feels like a wave or a movement or a group rather than action, which is individual. And I suppose if we're talking about tackling climate change, it's going to need a lot of action from a lot of individuals, and a lot of that would need to come from activism. So people with networks and a voice and some knowledge and some experience getting behind groups and leading groups and making sure that they're part of a big behaviour change campaign, because there's one that is required. We've got to change a lot. Even whether it's, you know, drawing down carbon or changing our behaviour so we don't make it any worse, or just surviving the disasters that are coming, there's a lot of changes that need to happen. It's unknown whether we're going to make it or not.
And I think that really is the big question. Like, our survival really depends on what we do right now. And there's that sense of urgency. We keep saying we're in a crisis and we need to act now, and all of these things need to be done so that we don't breach 1.5 degrees of warming, et cetera. But we know that we're on that trajectory where, like, that's already well and truly behind us. Like, we now need to think about what we're going to do to adapt, really, because that time for mitigation in a way has sort of passed, and we certainly can take steps to improve and correct some of the mistakes that we've made when it comes to the environment. But we're also at this kind of juncture where it's now or never, more than it ever has been before.
Yeah, that's right. And we're learning about what climate change means and what the disasters are actually going to be like. So I remember not that long ago kind of thinking, oh, well, it'll just get hot and we'll all just go to New Zealand, you know, it's a bit cooler down there, the temperature will rise a bit. And then you just look at New Zealand in the last month and you're like, floods in Auckland twice and then huge cyclone and storms and so on. And the face of disaster is not just things get a bit hotter, it is extreme weather, huge downfalls of rain, and then landslides. You know, there's Pūtakawa trees just sliding down the sides of mountains, or roads getting completely wiped out. It's like, that's not what I was thinking when early days when you were heard that the earth was warming. You think about rising sea levels and you're like, oh, it must be rough for the people on the coast, all that, you know, waterfront property is going to go under. It's actually water levels rising, backing up rivers so that there are floods in central Victoria, or, you know, inland sort of floods. So the actual impact is different to what we might have imagined. And as we get closer and get deeper into the effects of climate change, we're starting to see what the challenges will be. And it's back-to-back disasters. You know, there'll be communities that are still healing from the bushfires that are now dealing with floods. And even not necessarily climate change related disasters like earthquakes or COVID that may have been happening anyway are now woven in between a whole lot of natural and climate change related disasters. So shit's going to get hectic for the next little while. Yeah, we're going to do our best through this one.
Yeah. Pretty clear that nowhere and no one is safe necessarily with the scale of disasters that have happened, particularly in the last little while. I think you can look at the past 3 years even and think about, you know, the bushfires, the floods, just one disaster after the next that are impacting communities at such a scale that we're really all seeing and feeling the effects. Like, it's quite clear and obvious what's going on. And yeah, it's scary. But I think what comes through is that ability for communities to rally together and to help each other out and rebuild and regroup. And yeah, that's really all you can do is come together and try to survive.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, the worst thing will be if we all get a bit apathetic about it and burnt out because of the worry and the fear, which is certainly like an issue. There's, you know, you get hammered with the issues and the overwhelming challenges, and so much are so heavy on people that they end up being disempowered. So fresh legs, optimism, and a positive approach has got to go a long way. But connecting with youth and IndigMob and the environment, you know, series says falling in love with the earth again, which is great. Just, you know, reconnecting with the things that give us strength, feed our spirits so that we're up for the challenges, because it would be so easily for communities to just roll over and just say it's too hard. You know, the challenges of the future for one person are too hard. The pressures on kids growing up in a world that is, we just keep reiterating that it's doomed, is a lot. Call on your own strengths and supports where you can, and keep our spirits high.
Yes, that is all that can be done. And that's why we've got each other in the sectors we work in, the places that we live, the community organizations that provide those services and supports in times of crisis. That makes all the difference, keeping that optimism and that positivity, because things happen in life, you know, that's a given. It's really messy and ugly sometimes, but it's also this cycle of nature where, you know, it might rip through, but then there's something beautiful on the other side. I wanted to end asking you about your vision for an equitable and sustainable climate future and how people might be able to better take action and influence change in their own communities. Just your thoughts on that.
The thing that comes to mind is keep it local. It's about small, local, organized and sustainable communities. That's about nourishing what you've got, nurturing all your skills and your resources locally, and the global model of supply chains, capital and movement of labor is not what we want. It ain't going to work. Keeping it local, supporting your neighbours, sharing and getting around on a pushy instead of a car and so on, that's where it's at. I think it's about local governance. So just about all voices being heard, all decision makers considering all voices, and that's minorities, that's populace, that's everyone, that's Indige, that's all differently abled, everybody. So wherever there's the one, even the ones that are hard to hear their voice, that have gone off to hide from the humans because they don't want to be bothered, inclusion in mapping the path forward is really important in writing the blueprint for how to survive Earth and become sustainable is important.
Couldn't agree more. Ben, thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure chatting to you.
No worries.